Welcome to the Teach Suzuki podcast. I'm Paula Bird, and I invite you to spend the next few minutes with me talking about something that may change our world, one child, one family, and one community at a time. Hello, I hope you enjoyed the opening of this week's podcast episode. My students and I had fun coming up with recorded excerpts that would illustrate this week's episode, which is devoted to listening. We had a lot of fun coming up with these ideas to make the episode introduction stand out. Listening daily is a huge component to the Suzuki Method program. Dr. Suzuki developed his philosophy about learning and ability development because of his observations about how we listen and learn from our environment. In this episode, I will talk about why a regular listening program is important, and I will relate several interesting stories that will illustrate the power and magic that a good listening program will give to a student. I will tell you two really surprising stories about plants and rats that will amaze you and make you sit up and think about how listening affects your mood, brain development, and attitude. And one story talks about the power of listening to an unborn child. All very interesting and powerful stuff, and I look forward to sharing it with you. I will also talk about how a tweak in the listening environment can help a child through some sticky places in the Suzuki pieces. I will suggest ways that you can add more listening to your daily environment and what sorts of things that you can add to your listening playlists. So, why is listening important? If we have a healthy oral system, meaning that we were born with two ears that are functioning correctly, then we were born with some amazing and incredible tools for learning. We learned how to talk by listening to what was in our environment from birth and even before birth. As newborns, we were exposed to the spoken language all around us by other adults, children, media, and electronics. We couldn't have escaped this exposure unless we were living in a cave, and even then we would have been exposed to the sounds of nature around us. I want to start out by mentioning an interesting article that I read in Writer's Digest back in July of 1998 about listening while you work. This article was taken from the book The Mozart Effect, which was written by Don Campbell and printed by Avon Books. I will list a link to that book on Amazon in my show notes for the episode. But the article talks about the four different waves in the brain. There are beta waves, which are the brain waves when we are awake and conscious. These waves are 14 to 20 hertz. We basically have these brain waves when we go about our daily lives. The second brain wave is we have alpha waves, which are the brain waves during periods of heightened awareness and calm times. These are 8 to 13 hertz. Next are theta waves, which occur during peak moments of creativity, meditation, and regular sleep. And these are 4 to 7 hertz. And finally, the fourth brain wave is the delta wave, and these waves occur during deep sleep or deep meditation when we are basically unconscious. These are 1/2 to 3 hertz. So in a nutshell, the slower the brain wave, the more relaxed and peaceful we feel. Listening to music that has a rhythmic beat or pulse of about 60, which is the tick-tock of a clock second hand, that can shift our brain waves and consciousness from beta waves, you know, those being awake brain waves, to alpha waves, those heightened awareness and calm brain waves. Some music can help focus our mental thoughts, and other music can boost our creativity. Some music can strengthen memory and concentration, and other music can boost productivity. The article goes on to list all the various different kinds of music and the ways that these different styles of music might affect us. For example, slow music of Bach or Corelli, Handel or Vivaldi may stimulate a sharper mental focus when studying or working. Classical music of Haydn or Mozart may improve concentration and memory. Romantic music like Schubert and Tchaikovsky or Chopin may aid feelings of love or compassion. Impressionistic music of Debussy or Ravel may unlock creativity. Many types of music encourage energy, enthusiasm, and movement, such as jazz, Dixieland, calypso, salsa, big band, country western, rock music. I regularly clean my house while playing rumba music to spur me on to get the job done quicker. Religious music may inspire moods of deep peace and spiritual awareness and release feelings of pain. New Age music helps to induce relaxation. Heavy metal, punk, rap, hip-hop, and the like work to excite the nervous system and often lead to dynamic behavior and self-expression. And this last bit about music that excites the nervous system leads me to my two favorite stories. The first story involves two scientific experiments about listening. One involves rats, and the other experiment involves plants. I'm going to talk about the plant story first. In 1973, Dorothy Retallack published her book, The Sound of Music and Plants, which discussed her various experiments conducted at the Colorado Women's College. Mrs. Retallack placed plants in three different biotropic control chambers and conducted her experiments by piping various music or tones through the speakers into the rooms that housed the plants. In her first experiments, she learned that plants didn't like constant music being played. So constant music in our world is apparently not a good thing. Mrs. Retallack learned that the plants did better with intermittent music periods of about 3 hours each played periodically. This result was similar to the results that were found from experiments that Musec Corporation did in the 1980s, I think, with factory workers, that music played all the time was fatiguing to the workers. Apparently, plants like soothing music rather than rock music. Maybe I'm not too surprised about that. The plants preferred mainstream type middle-of-the-road music. They liked string music rather than steel drums. They showed no reaction to country western music, but they liked jazz a little bit. The plants were not big fans of Schoenberg or Webern, the modern 12-tone composers, but they liked North Indian classical music. So my favorite experiment done with the plants was the one that was related to the types of music being played in the rooms. In this experience, Mrs. Retallack played North Indian classical music of the sitar and tabla. In the second room, she played Bach organ music. And in the third chamber, she played nothing, silence. In the Bach room, the middle room, the plants leaned toward the speakers and thrived. But the plants in the Indian music chamber leaned toward the speakers the most. They were intertwining and blooming. It is interesting to note that in her experiments with the rock music, the plants would grow away from the speakers and eventually shrivel up and die. Now I'm going to move on to another story of experiments with sound and living organisms. And this is the one about the mice and rats. The rats were divided into three groups. Before listening to music, however, they ran the maze. It took them 3 minutes to run the maze. Then music was played to each of the three groups. One group was subjected to hard rock music. The second group was subjected to Mozart music. And the third group got no music of any kind. The mice ran the maze. And here are the amazing results. And remember that it took them 3 minutes to run the maze the first time. The mice who listened to silence were able to cut their maze running time in half. They did it in 1.5 minutes. The classical room mice completed the maze in 1/10 the time. It took these mice 30 seconds. But the mice who listened to heavy metal rock took 30 minutes to complete the maze, 10 times more than the first time. Well, I don't know about you, but these experiments have some influence on me. I am much more mindful about the kinds of music that I listen to on a regular basis. I listen to a variety of music, but I am more selective about the kind of music I listen to and also about the amount of time I expose myself to various kinds of music. In an article by Sherry Robertson, a Canadian musician, which was published in the American Suzuki Journal, which is the publication of the Suzuki Association of the Americas. It was volume 25.3, published in 1997. This article was called The Role of Listening. And in it, Miss Robertson relates two stories that I find quite powerful and have remembered over the years. If you are a mother, you will want to hear the second story. Miss Robertson's first story was about a train trip she took across Canada when she was 17. During this 21-hour train trip, she undertook to listen to a particular solo viola piece that she would be performing with her university orchestra in the future. She says that at the end of the long train journey, she felt that she had every part of the piece she was studying committed to memory. I myself have had a similar experience, which I will relate in a bit, but on to Miss Robertson's second story. When she was pregnant with her son, she and her husband chose to play a particular piece that they identified as the child's birth piece. They would play the piece, which was the Brahms horn, violin, and piano trio. They played the piece for the child by putting headphones on the sides of her stomach while the child was still in utero. After the child was born, the child slept a lot, never stayed awake for more than a few minutes at a time. But 47 hours after birth, the new mom played the birth piece again, and this was the first time the child would hear the music outside of the womb. So I'm going to relate the rest of the story in Ms. Robertson's own words. Quote, "Instantly, he snapped his head around to the source of the music and stayed there, transfixed, in a newborn's quiet, alert state with wide-open, slate-gray eyes for the entire duration of the Brahms horn trio, about 36 minutes." End quote. At the point in the third movement, when the horn hits the high-note climax, Miss Robertson recalled the feeling before birth of the child inside her pushing against her ribs at this particular spot in the music. When she played the music for the child after birth, at this same place in the music, she saw the child begin arching his back and stretching. Now, I recall one student from a very large family. She was about maybe the third or fourth child in a lineup of eight. As she progressed in her Suzuki journey, different siblings after her were born, and they all responded later during our studio recitals in different ways to the pieces that were the, what I called the birth pieces while they were in the utero. One sibling responded to Twinkles, another to Boccherini, and another one to Vivaldi, and finally, the last one was responding to the Bach double. It was very exciting for me to test out the stories that Miss Robertson had related about playing music to children in utero. Now, why do these experiments turn out like this? One theory that I believe is that these experiments illustrate how the human body responds to the natural life force or life rhythm. Music can follow along with this natural rhythm, or it can work against it. So let me sing for you how that works, or let me show you how that works. Classical music has a propelling rhythmic pulse that matches the natural propulsion of our heartbeat. Ta-dum, 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 about 60, like the ticking of a clock. However, what we know is rock music often has a rhythmic pulse that goes the opposite way. Take the famous song, you know, we will rock you, boom. Rock you, boom. It goes da-da-stop, da-da-stop. So you see how the beat then plays on the way your body feels? It sort of pushes against you so that your heartbeat feels like it has to work, and then it stops beating. You know, there was an interesting video floating around the internet of an experiment in Liverpool England, that had a bunch of metronomes sitting on top of a board resting on soda cans. The experiment started out with all of the metronomes set at different rates of beating, but over time, the metronomes began to vibrate together, and ultimately, they beat simultaneously. That is so way cool. But that's what I believe happens to us with repeated exposure to vibrations. I know that when I am surrounded by extremely loud rock music, that I actually find it hurts me a bit. My chest actually starts to hurt. In a way, I think this is just like eating sugar, something that may not be good for you. It's okay once in a while, but overdosing on it would not be a great idea. So, do you remember those examples from the Writer's Digest article about the effects on brainwaves and our moods that different music has? Remember the different ways that classical music and rock music affected plants and rats? So let me raise the question about why I think it's very important to include healthy doses of classical music. Perhaps you still think that any sort of music will be okay. Well, music is important, and our culture has many different ways to express ourselves creatively with different genres of music. But this is what I tell my studio parents when asked to make recommendations about classical music versus, let's say, fiddle music, for example. Now, I want you to understand, I'm a very huge banjo fan, and I love listening to fiddle and bluegrass music. So I don't want you to interpret this as some kind of slam on that kind of music, because it is not. I enjoy listening to it and listen to it regularly. However, I also have a very healthy amount of classical music in my diet for my brain food. I sort of think of classical music as like the protein of my listening diet, because popular music tends to be popular because it is easy to remember. And why is popular music so easy to remember? It's simpler. We hear one or two times and already we're humming or clapping along with the music. It's easy to remember because it generally just has a few things to remember about it. Perhaps there's just a few verses and they all share the same music. And there's a repeating chorus or refrain, you know, the catchy part of the song that we all remember and sing along with. The harmonies are generally more simple. The rhythms are easy to tap our feet to or clap along with. And the melodies are not too difficult to get our vocal cords around. Now, classical music, on the other hand, is quite different. Oh, yes. Many of us can hum along to the main tune of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. La 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 da 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 da. Oh, yes. Even children hear that one. Or perhaps we know that famous Mozart Eine kleine Nacht music tune. Dum, bum, 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 bum. Pardon my lovely singing, but classical music is very different than popular music in several respects. So take a symphony orchestra piece, for example. There may be anywhere from 40 to 80 musicians playing in the piece, rather than one or five or 10 people at the most, involved in a country song with a strong drum beat also that also keeps them together when they sing along. And there may be as many as 40 things going on in a symphony at the same time. Wrap your brain around that phenomenon. It's incredible to absorb that, isn't it? At the same time, 40 different things, and your brain is having fun listening to all of that and separating out the different lines. There has been an interesting little animated video floating around the internet about what happens in our brain when we listen to music. The video tells us that it's like having a party going on inside our brains. And when we play music, such as playing a musical instrument, it's like having fireworks going off all around the inside of our heads. Now, that's a sure stimulation of our brains, isn't it? When I first studied to be a Suzuki teacher, I didn't know all the pieces in some of the later books. I wasn't familiar with them. So I started adding these pieces into my daily listening. And I want to talk about one example. I listened to the book 5, Veracini Gig, several times, but I think I, at that point, had only tried playing it maybe one or two times. So one night, as I was waiting for a symphony concert to begin, I was warming up on stage. I finished practicing the music that we would be performing that evening, and then I found myself sitting in my symphony chair with nothing to do for about 5 minutes. So I started fiddling around with the Veracini Gig. To my amazement, I then proceeded to play that piece for an entire page and a half before I finally had to stop because I could not believe that I was actually doing it right. I mean, surely not, I thought. So I turned to my symphony neighbor, who was also a Suzuki teacher, and told her what was happening to me at the moment. She laughed and she said, "Well, isn't the Suzuki method amazing?" Well, I knew it was, but it wasn't until that particular moment that I was completely convinced about the power of listening. As a Suzuki teacher, I often amaze my students and parents when I can tell that a student has not kept up with the daily listening requirement. Even if the student skips one day, the results are pretty obvious to me. I have seen students lack confidence about how a song goes. I hear incorrect rhythms or notes, and there's a general slowdown in how a student recalls the music. As a professional, I have experienced this same thing myself. I remember preparing for one recital, and I rehearsed weekly with my pianist. On some weeks, I would have lots of practice time, but little time to listen to my recital music playlist. And those rehearsals were slow. I felt so unsure about how my pianist part fit in with my own part. I lacked confidence about what I was supposed to play, and so on. There were other rehearsals when I had practiced less because of a busy schedule, but I made sure to do my daily listening to my recital repertoire, and those rehearsals were the best. I just sailed through them. So I became convinced a long time ago that listening daily was the most important thing I could do in my practice regimen. I recall watching a student struggle through the Vivaldi's Concerto in A Minor during an Institute masterclass. I knew the mom of this particular student quite well, so I felt comfortable having a conversation with her after the lesson. I suggested that mom go home and play the music for the child at least four times that night. She did it, and the results were amazing the next day. The child just sailed through the piece with little hesitation. So whenever I have students who struggle to learn a new piece or remember an old one, I often suggest adding extra listening to the daily routine. "But I don't have time to listen," you might be saying. And then I just have to ask, "Really? Maybe you aren't sure what I mean by a listening environment. So let me talk about that." There are many different ways that you can listen to something, and each of these ways have benefits to them. Sometimes I even wonder if it matters which way that we use, and perhaps that's a great subject for some scientific experiments. But for now, let's just look at the different ways. We can sit down and look at the music while we listen to the music. We can sit and listen to the piece while we do nothing else to distract us. We can sit and listen to the piece while we are doing something else. We can set our volume so that the music is in our background and repeats over and over. And by background volume, I mean that you don't feel the need to raise your voice to talk over the music. So when you set the volume like this correctly, you will pretty much forget that it's playing within minutes. In the Nurtured by Love film, which you can order from the Suzuki Association of the Americas, which you can find at suzukiassociation.org, you will see examples of how Japanese mothers found ways to add music listening to the child's daily environment. And these were the days before we had iPods and smartphones and cassette players, and portable Walkmans and all those. These were in the days when we only had cassettes available to us. So there will be pictures of the youngsters with tiny cassette recorders strapped to their backs while they played in the sandboxes. I recall visiting one student's home to find the children playing basketball in the driveway, and the mother had the nearby windows open as she played the Suzuki songs through the window. I thought that was a very clever use of space and time to get those song listening done. So here are some other ways that you could add listening to your daily routine. You could listen during mealtimes. You could listen during car rides. You could listen before bed during the getting ready for sleep ritual. You could listen when the child gets up in the morning, during nap times, or when falling asleep at night. You could listen while playing or while doing schoolwork or homework. So as you can see, you can play music pretty much all day long. Now, the next thing is to be sure that you have the equipment that will allow you to play the music. And so here are some ways that other families have found to make sure that listening happens every day. They have a portable CD player or some other stereo system, such as through a TV system. You could use an iPod or some other MP3 player. You could use your iPad or your smartphone and use a playlist of the Suzuki songs there. You could play the songs through your computer with headphones. You could play it in the car or the truck using the CD player. Or now a lot of new vehicles have the plug-in adapter so that you can plug in your MP3 or your smartphone playlist through the car speaker system. I also ask parents to be sure that the equipment stays in good working order. There have been times when parents take a vehicle in for routine maintenance, servicing, and then forget to have another avenue available for listening in another vehicle. Nowadays, many cars and trucks have that capability to play their songs on their phone and other mobile devices, so you can just plug in from one car to another. But if you're still driving an older model, then you only have the CD system available, so making sure that the CD gets moved from one vehicle to the next is a good thing. And usually when a student of mine is having problems with listening, I discover that a breakdown has happened in the system of listening. Either the CD got broken or scratched or somebody misplaced it, something like that. So now's a good time to check your equipment and the source of your playing material and make sure you have it all lined up and put together. And how about making sure you have that music ready to be listened to? So most listening devices now are easily set up with playlists. You can take the tracks that you want to listen to and make a separate playlist, and boom, just hit that button and there you go. The Suzuki repertoire is now available on iTunes, so you can download it to a playlist with a snap of your finger. And with the growth of YouTube, there is so much music as well as music and videos available for everyone. Just be sure that you expose your child to the best that the videos can offer rather than little Susie's recital when she was 3 years old. Maybe not the best example, but then again, maybe it's a fabulous recording and you'll have to make that decision. Role modeling through a listening program is quite effective, too. Ask your child's teacher what he or she recommends regarding performers to listen to or videos to watch. And please make sure that you stay tech savvy along with your child, because I assure you that your child is quite up to date, even if you yourself feel that you have kept your child from internet exposure. Technology is quite prevalent in our world. This may be sadly to say, but that is the truth of it. And your child will be exposed to it sometime, somewhere. At school, a friend's home, TV commercials, other people's photo albums. I remember one mom who complained to me about how hard it was for her to figure out how to use her iPhone when she first got it. At that point, her 3-year-old son picked up her iPhone, swiped his finger, and called me right there on the spot. So mom and I laughed about that because I assure you, if a 3-year-old can do it, then a parent can easily learn to do it too. So I'm sorry to go off on this tangent about internet technology and savviness and stuff, but I do worry sometimes that there are some parents out there who hesitate to learn about the new technology, and I fear that they are ill-equipped to handle their child's internet explorations when they are going to occur, and they will occur. So this has been a very comprehensive episode about listening, and I'm sure I haven't covered everything. So please let me know what you think that I should add. I would love to offer some additional ideas for my listeners in future episodes or on blog posts. So I hope that you'll contact me or comment about ways that you incorporate listening in your home or teaching environment. And I'm always dealing with this issue. This is so important. So I look for new ways to help my parents and students get their daily listening going. So next week, I want to talk about what I think is important for my studio parents to know. One of my studio parents recently talked to me about how the strong impact the Suzuki experience has had on her psychology as a parent who is also teaching her child in a homeschool program. This parent has bumped up against Dr. Suzuki's thoughts about how parents need to reflect about their own problems before they can address those of their children. This parent was just beginning to comprehend the power of that statement as it relates to her own personal upbringing as a child of her parents. I like to spend some time talking about how our past childhood history has affected us negatively and positively as parents and teachers. So if you have thoughts about this or personal experience to share that relate to this topic or the episode about listening that I just went through, be sure and let me know. I would love to include them in the next episode. You can call and leave me a voicemail comment if you prefer at 512-537-6356. And you can always email me at paulabirdviolin@gmail.com. And please be sure to visit my website, teachsuzuki.com, for the show notes about today's episode and the links to the book that I mentioned about the Mozart effect, as well as to other links such as the Suzuki Association of the Americas. And I have been posting my blog focus about listening this month, so visit the blog at teachsuzuki.com for more helpful articles about listening. Until next time, happy practicing. This is Paula Bird signing off from the Teach Suzuki podcast, where we talk about how to change our world one child, one family, and one community at a time.